Welcome to this evening's lecture organised by LSE Ideas, particularly our China Forum, under Dr. Yu over there, who's been doing a great job. Question we're going to be looking at tonight is not an unimportant one, as Mr. Trump made clear in the election and the build-up to that election. What is America going to do with China? Now, it looks like he's going to punish China several times over on all sorts of issues, currency, stealing American jobs, and doing all sorts of other appalling things to the United States. So it's pretty clear China was a very political question in the last presidential, and indeed in nearly every presidential I can remember, going back to 1972. But then I'm a good deal older than most people in this audience, with one or two notable exceptions. Anyway, so we couldn't have a more important topic to be thinking about, more actual, coming out of the elections and more general. And this evening I'm absolutely delighted to welcome two speakers, one from the home team, and Margaret has been here so often now, I'm beginning to wonder, Margaret, whether we should bring you as part of the home team as well. But anyway, first and foremost, it's great to bring Margaret Macmillan, Professor Macmillan, Canadian, educated in Canada, I always like to point out, and in Oxford, and I say many distinctions, including being the great-granddaughter of Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister. I always say that because I live not very far away from where Lloyd George was born, up in Aberystwyth in West Wales, and many, many other respects, a formidable person in the academic world and warden of St. Anthony's College up in Oxford. Margaret has written on a variety of issues. I think your first book, Margaret, if I got your CV correct, was Woman of the Raj, Women of the Raj, Mothers and Wives, Daughters of the British Empire in India in 1988. Her best-selling book, which I think really defined the subject, on peacemakers and the Paris Peace Conference of 1919. And related to what we're going to talk about this evening, what Margaret is going to talk about, her book called Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World, which was published in 2008. Margaret, you're welcome yet again here to the school. Chris Coker, I don't think the LSE needs very much introduction. Chris has been teaching here for many years, lectures in the International Relations Department, and has written one book after another, which, as I said the other day, has defined him as the Clausewitz of Houghton Street. He also comes up with the best titles of books: Warrior Geeks, How 21st Century Technology is Changing the Way We Fight; Barbarous Philosophers, Reflections on the Nature of War from Heraclitus to Heisenberg, and many, many other. But it related to this evening, not very long ago, Christopher wrote a book called The Improbable War: China, the United States, and the Logic of Great Power Conflict, which I noticed was reviewed in a well-known foreign policy journal called Foreign Affairs by John Eikenberry, who said that Christopher was going after the liberals. I can't believe it, Christopher, for a second. Anyway, it's great to have you here this evening, a very busy evening here at the LSE. The title of our debate and lecture this evening, called Clash of the Titans, sorry about that, I thought it would bring more people in, and it seems to have worked. China-US Relations from Nixon to Trump. And to start the proceedings off, I wonder if we can give an LSE welcome to Professor Margaret.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm glad the Clash of the Titans doesn't mean Professor Croker and myself.
No. You're both titans, but you don't have to clash.
We may disagree. I'm going to actually go back beyond Nixon, because I think to understand the relationship between China and the United States, it's useful to understand how it's evolved through history. It began as part of that move of Western powers around the world, looking for markets, in some cases looking for territory. And they were aided by a brief, very brief advantage in technology, in military organization, which enabled them to move rapidly, in the case of the British Empire, for example, into India, enabled them to move rapidly into parts of Asia, enabled them in the 19th century to carve up Africa. The European powers and the United States tended to be regarded in the rest of the world as part of the West, although it's always been a very special part of the West. It's always been a very distinct power. The United States was often seen in the non-European world as simply part of this wave, but I would argue that the relationship between the United States and the non-European world has been rather a different one. The Americans have always been very conscious of the fact that they were once colonies, that they were a nation, they belonged to a nation founded in an act of rebellion against a European power and against, in some ways, European ways of doing things. Now, that may not always seem apparent to those nations at the receiving end of American attentions in the Caribbean, for example, or in Latin America, but the American concept of themselves, I think, is an important part of this story. The relationship between China and the United States began in the late 18th century when Western traders were coming out to look for goods from China and in turn were trying to find goods to sell to China in order to finance the trade. And as we know, one of the chief goods they found was opium. It was an expanding market. The arguments made by those who were selling drugs to the Chinese were very much like the arguments made today by people who sell drugs or by people who sell rifles or handguns to people, that it's really the consumer's choice. And they're not forcing people to buy handguns and shoot each other. They're not forcing people to buy drugs and take them. It is simply a choice the consumers are making. And the Americans were part of that early trade. And there's some very, very respectable families in Boston, for example, whose ancestors made their fortunes in the opium trade with China. The Chinese tended always, I would say, throughout the 19th century, to see the Americans both as being part of this Western predatory movement into China, but also to see the Americans as somehow different. There was a hope that the Americans would behave differently, and in some ways the Americans did behave differently in China. And I think for a lot of the Chinese nationalists who came of age in the period before the First World War and just after, who were looking for ways to deal with the manifest problems that China had. I mean, they were living through the end of a dynasty. They were living at a time when China was divided and weak and a prey to outside powers. For a lot of the Chinese young nationalists, those who wanted radical reform of Chinese society, the United States was something they looked to. And a young Mao Zedong, in the years before the First World War, had as his two great heroes Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. Seeing them as people who transformed their own society and might perhaps provide a model for the Chinese. And so you had this complicated relationship, the Americans seeing China as a market, the Chinese seeing the United States as, yes, part of the West, but believing that in some ways, certainly among the younger generations of nationalists, that it might be somehow different. What you also got on the American side was not just a desire to trade in China, but a desire to save Chinese souls. I mean, it was, in a way, the same mercantilist impulse. There were lots of consumers there in China, lots of labor there in China, but also lots of souls to be saved. And the American missionary effort in China was large and played a very important part in shaping American perceptions of China. And so American perceptions were shaped both through trade and also through the missionaries who would be sponsored by individual American churches and who would come back and tell those churches about what they had been doing. And so China was seen both as a country to be exploited, but also as a country to be helped. There was also another element, and I think you get this throughout the relationship, a country to be exploited, a country to be helped. I mean, we see this throughout the period of the relationship between the United States and China, but also a country that should at times be feared. And you see it in the popular literature before and after the First World War, the sense that the Chinese are people who possess ancient wisdom. And no one ever knows what ancient wisdom is, but it sounds absolutely terrifying. And if you've ever read the Fu Manchu books or seen the Fu Manchu movies, there is this sense that somehow the Chinese know things that Americans don't know and that they possess powers that Americans don't have and that you had better be careful of them. And that perception of China somehow possessing magical or semi-magical powers is something I think that also feeds in to the fears of Chinese emigration to the United States, again around the time of the First World War. This fear that these alien hordes are coming with their strange ways and coming to change and perhaps corrupt American society. And so I think in the relationship you get these different strands. The tendency of the United States to look to China as a wonderful market, as a place to find cheap labor, tendency on the United, part of the United States at the same time to see it as a country in need of help, in need of salvation, if you're religious, if you're not religious, as a country in need of American-style democracy and American-style ways of doing things. But also the fears that are somehow there and often come out in the relationship that somehow China represents a menace to the American way of life. And I think you get the similar sets of responses on the Chinese side. You get this response that the United States is just like any other Western power, out to exploit China for its own ends. But you also get, certainly I think among young radicals in China, over and over again you get a sense that the United States might be something to be emulated, the United States might be something to be admired, and a recognition on the part of many Chinese nationalists that the United States is perhaps less predatory, or was in the past less predatory than other other Western powers. The United States, for example, before the First World War, that talked about an open door policy, set its face against the division of China and argued that everyone should be able to trade freely in China. Now, this, of course, benefited the United States, but it was seen by at the time by Chinese as a more benevolent attitude towards China than many of the other Western powers had. I mean, before the First World War, Western powers were very busy planning how they were going to divide up China, and they were building railway lines into China, which really began to mark out a possible division of China. The French came up from the south, the British came along the Yangtze River, the Russians were busy in the north, the Germans claimed the Shandong Peninsula and were busy moving in. And what Chinese nationalists feared, rightly, was that the country was on the verge of being carved up. The United States was the one country that was not trying to stake out bits of territory in China, not trying to squeeze out concessions in China, not trying to get concessions which gave it the right to build ports, the right to exploit mines. And so for the Chinese, the United States was seen in the same sort of complicated way that the Americans saw the Chinese, as something that was, yes, predatory, but perhaps less so and perhaps more benevolent and perhaps had things that might be emulated. And so these different ways that the two sides look at each other, I think, really persist, and you can see one or the other coming out. The relationship is never a static one. The relationship has changed over time, but you can see certain themes, certain strands that occur again and again. The relationship, I think, is also difficult and complicated because both, in a way, see themselves as civilizations. They see themselves as models for the rest of the world. I mean, very early American governor of Massachusetts talked about Massachusetts, and this phrase came to be used for the United States when it became independent, as the shining city on the hill, that it somehow represents a better form of human organization, a better form of political and social organization than anything that was happening elsewhere in the world, and it should therefore be emulated. And just as American missionaries wanted to save Chinese souls, you can also see American statesmen and American thinkers talking about the need to promote the American model around the world. I mean, Woodrow Wilson is a classic example of this. So is George Bush II, that somehow the United States is the sort of model the rest of the world should follow if it wants to be happy. If the world is to be peaceful, if the world is to be safe, if the world is to be made up of nations freely trading with each other, it is the American model that should be followed. And although, again, in the United States you've had a recoil from that with isolationism, I think for a lot of Americans, the United States has a positive obligation to get out and promote its message around the world. And of course you get, if not similar, but you certainly get, in the case of China, a sense that China incorporates a way of doing things, that it has done so successfully. It has managed a very large landmass, managed a very large population over the centuries with, you know, an extraordinary amount of success. I mean, it has not always ended in success. There have been dreadful periods in Chinese history when there have been upheavals, revolution, civil wars. But the longevity of the Chinese, the old Chinese system, is something, I think, that a lot of Chinese rightly take pride in. And so I think what you get complicating the relationship, and I think you can see it today and you can see it in the past, is this sense that both are putting themselves forward as models for the rest of the world, that they have a way of doing things which is the right way. And I do think this I think we still see this. Well, I won't go through the whole history of American-Chinese relations, but of course they became very, very complicated as a result of the development of Chinese nationalism in the 1920s and 1930s, when the Kuomintang successfully united China. The Americans initially were apprehensive. They thought the Kuomintang under Chiang Kai-shek were dangerous revolutionaries. They saw that they had allied with the communists in the First United Front in the 1920s, and they feared what they saw as dangerous anti-Western revolutionary tendencies. But as Chiang Kai-shek managed to incorporate the different provinces of China, managed to bring back the provinces of China under central government control in the late 1920s and early 1930s, the United States increasingly saw him as someone who was doing good for China and increasingly offered support to him. He came to be seen less as a dangerous revolutionary and more as someone who was a modernizer who was going to bring a much-needed order and coherence to what had been a very, very troubled polity. And so gradually the United States shifted into a position of sympathizing with, lending money to, and supporting in diplomatic ways the new nationalist, the Kuomintang government of China. And when that government began to feel the pressure from Japanese aggression, first in Manchuria, of course, in 1931, and then after 1937, with a full-scale Japanese invasion of the great coastal swath of China, which started with the incident at the Marco Polo Bridge in Beijing, the United States came more and more to see itself and came more and more to be seen by the Japanese and by the Chinese as the supporter of the Chinese nationalist government. And so by the time the Second World War broke out in Asia, and the Chinese had already, of course, been fighting since 1937, but when the war turned into a much larger war with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States was firmly committed to supporting China. And although some American aid went to the Chinese communists, and there was an American mission, military mission to the Chinese communists in the Second World War, most of the American aid went to the Kuomintang. It was seen as the force most likely to defeat the Japanese. And it was a much bigger force. Its armies was three times the size of the communist army. So in a way, it was a very rational choice of the Americans. What happened as the war wound down, and as it became clear that there was likely to be a scramble for power between the Chinese communists and the Kuomintang, the Americans slid, and I think without any very conscious policy decision, and Washington had a lot to preoccupy it in 1945, and I'm not sure they were really following what was going on in China with close attention, the United States government slid almost imperceptibly from supporting the Kuomintang against Japan to supporting the Kuomintang against the Chinese communists. And when the Chinese Civil War broke out in 1946, the Americans found themselves in the position of supporting the Kuomintang against the communists. They never did so wholeheartedly. There was always talk later in the United States that somehow the United States could have done more, that somehow the United States lost China, that somehow they could have prevented the defeat of the Kuomintang by the Chinese communists by 1949. I don't think this is the case at all. The United States was not prepared to put enormous resources into China. They didn't have the ground troops to put in. They would have taken far more than they could possibly supply. Now, the attitude, as far as I can see in Washington, and I've just been reading about it, was that we will give some support to the Kuomintang, and we hope they don't lose, but we suspect that they might. And I think at least initially there were those in Washington in 1949 who thought they could talk to the new communist government, who felt that they didn't like it, but after all they'd talked to a Soviet communist government, they simply would deal with whatever government was there in China. What changed that was the Cold War. The rapid deterioration of relations between the United States and the Soviet Union meant that China now began to be seen as a player in the Cold War. And when Mao Zedong very publicly went to Moscow, his first trip after he got power was to Moscow, where he stayed for several months, and said, China will lean to one side. China has chosen a side in the Cold War. This was seen in the United States as China simply now being manipulated by the Soviet Union, doing what the Soviet Union told it. If there was ever any hope that the United States and China would, the now communist China, would have any sort of relationship, it was ended, I think, both by the Cold War and by the fact that in 1949 the Soviet Union exploded its atomic bomb several years before the Americans thought they'd be able to do so, and that plunged the Cold War into an even more intense state. And then, of course, in 1950 the Korean War broke out, and American troops found themselves fighting Chinese troops. And that put American-Chinese relations into a deep freeze. If there were those on both sides who said, this actually doesn't make sense, we're two very powerful countries, we both have interests in Asia, we should at least talk to each other, their voices were not going to be heard in either the United States or China. And that situation lasted up until the beginning of the 1970s. It was, in many ways, an absurd situation. The most populous nation in the world, a major Asian power, and the most powerful nation in the world in the shape of the United States not talking to each other. Occasionally, they had to have very, very low-level talks, which they usually did in Warsaw. They had to do things like exchanging prisoners of war, and they did so very, very quietly. In both countries, I think, there was an unwillingness to contemplate any change in the relationship. What changed that was, I think, a number of developments. The United States was hurting very badly as a result of the Vietnam War. When Nixon was elected president at the end of 1968, he was determined to get the United States out of Vietnam, and he felt, wrongly as it turned out, the way to do that was to go through Beijing. He felt the Chinese, if he could do a deal with them, would put sufficient pressure on North Vietnam to make peace. What it turned out was North Vietnam wasn't going to be pressured by anyone, but the Americans had this hope that Beijing would help them extricate themselves from the mess in Vietnam. And opinion was beginning to change in China as well. And China was pretty much friendless at the end of the 1960s. It was on very bad terms with India. It had had a war with India in 1962. It had no relationship with Japan. It had no relationship with the United States. It had various relationships in the Third World and among small and insignificant countries in Europe. Its most fervent ally in Europe was Albania. And Albania is a very beautiful country, but it's not a country you're going to rely on if you are China, faced by enemies. And, of course, what worried the Chinese most of all was that relations with the Soviet Union had deteriorated to the point by which, in 1969, people in China were afraid, with some reason, that the Soviet Union was planning a sneak nuclear attack to knock out Chinese industrial capacity and make it impossible for China to fight the Soviet Union. And there were armed clashes along the common border in 1969. And so opinion began to change in China, and that meant Mao's opinion, because Mao still had a dominant role in foreign policy, and he began to contemplate the possibility of an opening to the United States. He said to his doctor, the memoir is wonderful, although I think in the People's Republic it's not regarded as authentic. My view is that it probably is fairly close to what happened. And Mao said to his doctor, you know, he said, I'm thinking of talking to the United States. And he said, I've always thought of the old precept in Chinese statecraft that if you have two enemies, make friends with the one furthest away. It's safer. If you make friends with the one that's your neighbor, then you're going to be in trouble because they're too close to you. And so with a willingness and a need on both sides to shift the relationship, the famous deal was brokered. Henry Kissinger made his famous flight in secret from Pakistan to Beijing to talk about a visit by Nixon in 1971. And there's a lovely story. This was kept very, very secret because the Americans didn't want to face any embarrassment if the Chinese weren't prepared to carry through with an invitation. And so the visit was done in secret. It was said that Henry Kissinger was sick. He'd gone to a small place in the hills in Pakistan to recover. And a stringer, someone who worked for Reuters, a local person who worked for Reuters, was at the airport in Rawalpindi that night and noticed a great deal of sort of fuss going on. And he said to one of the policemen, what is happening? And the policeman pulled himself up and saluted and said, Mr. Kissinger's going on a secret trip to China, sir. Well, he phoned his head office in London. He said, I got a scoop. I mean, this was one of the scoop of the centuries. Huge diplomatic transformation. He phoned his office in London, and when he sort of finished telling the story, they put the phone down and said, he's been drinking. So the story was never told. But it was a very, very important moment. Nixon went to China in 72, and symbolically it was hugely important. Nothing much was actually agreed there. They issued a very extraordinary communique which it said, we disagree on the following areas, which is not what you usually do in communiques. You usually said we've come to an agreement. The Shanghai communique is an interesting document which you might want to look at. But something had changed. It did not, however, immediately transform Chinese-American relations for various reasons. It was really going to take until 1978 that the promise of that opening began to bear fruit. And that was partly because there was a political crisis in China. Chairman Mao died in 1976, and then there was the crisis over who would succeed him. And so China was turned inwards, preoccupied with what was going inwards, and the United States had its own little crisis in the form of Watergate. And so Nixon was preoccupied with that, driven from office in 1974, and his successor, Gerald Ford, wasn't interested in really doing much with China. And so it really took a change of regimes, both in China and the United States, for them to build on that opening. And it was after 1978 that it began to happen very, very quickly indeed. And you suddenly had this extraordinary opening up. I mean, Deng Xiaoping, who came to power in 1978, deciding very consciously that he would open up the world in China. He would open up China to foreign learning, foreign technology. He would send young Chinese abroad to study to try and make up for the depredations of the Cultural Revolution. And once he unleashed the force of the Chinese people, once he made it possible for people to innovate, once he made it possible for people to work for profit, once he made it possible for people to begin to move out of the very, very tightly controlled society that Mao had imposed, then China began to expand enormously. And the, you know, the success story of China is one that has taken place really in a generation. I mean, the China of 1978 is so different from the China of 2016. It seems almost like two different worlds, although there are a lot of people who remember them. There are so many, you know, most people of my age or younger in China have lived through this extraordinary transformation. And what we've also seen, I think, is China becoming more and more part of the international system. The Chinese have been very strong proponents of rules, of organizations. They've joined a great number of international organizations, and now, of course, they're trying to set up their own. They, I think, possibly will not be like other rising powers in the past that sometimes have wanted to disrupt the international system. If we're lucky, and this seems to be the pattern so far, the Chinese actually want an international system. They may think it should be run in different ways. They may think they should have a greater role in running it. But I think they're not disruptive power, not a disruptive power in the same way perhaps that Germany was in the years before the First World War. There still are, I think, enormous question marks, and I'm going to leave that to the other speaker. I just want to leave you with the thought, and perhaps this is something I'm sure you know much more about than me, is China sufficiently embedded in the international system? Are its relations sufficiently strong with the United States? You know, and for all the ups and downs, the countries are still trading with each other. Chinese government, China is the biggest purchaser of U.S. Treasury bonds. There are huge links now between the Chinese people and the American people. Large numbers of Americans living in China, visiting China. I forget how many Americans. I think it's 3 million Americans or more go to China every year as tourists. And a great many more go to work and study there. And large numbers of Chinese, of course, living and working and studying and visiting the United States. And so it's not just a state-to-state relationship, it's also, I think, increasingly a people-to-people relationship. And more Americans are struggling to learn Mandarin because they feel this really is the language that they need if they're going to try and deal with the New World Order. What I think is the question now is something that the political scientists call the man can never pronounce it, the Thucydides trap, that a rising power is always destined to fight a declining power. And are we seeing this pattern repeated yet again? I'm actually slightly skeptical of the Thucydides trap, because I think the examples that political scientists tend to use are limited. I think they don't look at examples which perhaps run counter to what they're saying. And we can see in the past very successful examples of nations managing their relative shift in the world order. The United States and Britain nearly came to war. Certainly there was talk of war in the 1890s, and they both pulled back. They recognized this would be foolish, and they came to a deal. And the British essentially withdrew from any involvement militarily in North America. They left that now to the United States. And so I think it is possible to manage these relationships, and I think what we have to hope is that the links of trade, of investment, the government-to-government links, but also the links among the peoples of both countries, will help to keep what has been a complicated relationship, but help to keep it a friendly one. It's not always going to be very friendly. They are different nations with different interests, but I think we have to hope that they will both see that they, at all levels, that they have a shared interest in maintaining the peace and not getting into a conflict. So let's hope that the trap is one they'll avoid. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Margaret. And Christopher,
over to you.
Thank you very much, Mick. Well, I'm going to try and bring things up to date, to Donald Trump. Margaret McMillan has mentioned a few things that I will reiterate, if I may. I'm going to start with the past, however. I'm going to start with the editor of Time Life magazine, Henry Luce, who in 1944 coined the term the American century. Luce was the son of American missionaries in China. He was born in China. So it was natural that he should take an interest in Asia. Towards the end of his life, he suggested that the 21st century would largely be shaped by America's ambitions in the Asian Pacific region. And the great challenge, he wrote, would be whether the United States could bring the East and West together. Now, don't imagine that Luce was a 20th century figure. He wasn't. He thought to begin with that the East had nothing to say to the West. But he was atypical, perhaps, for his times, in adding that the West had only had a future if the East was receptive to Western ideas. And for him, the greatest setback of Chinese-American relations, of course, had been, as we've just heard, the loss, in quotes, of China in 1949. So when I was asked by Nick Cox to speak at this meeting, I thought the American century would be the context in which to place the future of the US-China dialogue, because, of course, the American century is over. And we're now talking about the prospect of a Chinese century, which may or not be about to begin. Or, if you prefer a different writer, we can go back to Gramsci and his famous formulation that the old order is not yet dead, but it's dying, and the new order is not yet born. But before I identify what I consider the three essential differences between the dialogue between China and the United States in the days of President Nixon and today, soon in the days of President Trump, let me begin with one very important element of commonality which Margaret mentioned in her talk, which is that China and the United States have been more fascinated in each other over the last 100 years than I think any other countries have been fascinated in one another. The very word America in Chinese is composed of a character meaning beautiful and a character for country. And as far as China has been concerned, it's a love-hate relationship. A great deal of suspicion because America is a Western society, but it is not a typical Western society. It was not bound in with the century of humiliation in the 19th century. And for Americans, China has always been the great hope. They dreamed, as you've heard, of converting China to Christianity. There are 380 million Pentecostalists in China today. It's the fastest growing religion in China. People now talk with some confidence, rightly or wrongly, of the fact that the Pacific Rim, both West and East, will one day be Christian. They were fascinated, of course, by the Chinese market. Because if you're a good capitalist, this, of course, is the biggest consumer market in the world. And they've been fascinated by the prospects of democracy. A very early Rockefeller Foundation report suggested, and I quote, that China was plastic in its democratic potentiality, whatever that means. And that, of course, has been the great Chinese fear, where the Americans are doing the dreaming, not the Chinese. And that's why back in 1943, in Chongqing, which was being bombed at the time by Japanese bombers, the young Owen Lattimore, who's an American scholar in China, Chongqing was the capital of nationalist China at the time, was amazed to overhear a conversation between two Chinese officials, not about the war of Japan, but the coming war with the United States. Japan was not a threat to China in terms of values, identities, or ideas. It was a military threat. The United States was, they identified, the great threat. These weren't communists. These were nationalists. These were people allied to the United States at the time. So, what are the major differences between the Nixon and Mao years? Let me just identify three. There was a bipolar world in 1972 when Richard Nixon went to Beijing. It was the world of the Cold War. It was a world of two superpowers and their respective alliance systems. Today, it's a multipolar world, but the key player is still, surprise, surprise, Russia. For Henry Kissinger, who engineered the détente between China and the United States, the fear, he says, that keeps him awake at night is the prospect of an alliance between China and Russia ganging up against the United States. That, he said, would be an endgame for American foreign policy. The United States could not actually deal with that challenge. In 2016, a senior European official told the New York Times columnist Roger Cohen, you may read his columns from time to time, Russia is a loser's challenge, he said, to the West, because it's given up on globalization and modernization and it's in terminal decline. China is a winner's challenge because it's embarked on both modernization and globalization with a vengeance. China's policy is driven by strength, Russia's by weakness. One is experiencing the fastest economic uplift in history. The other is experiencing, even with the oil price going up yesterday, decline. But this tends to gloss over the fact that they share one thing in common. China, David Shambaugh insists, suffers from acute status anxiety. Mm. And Russia suffers from a profound resentment about its present position in the world. It's no longer a world power. It plays at being so. And the thing is this, that if the West is not willing to concede ground, to accept the need for change, that the rules of the international system will have to be renegotiated to reflect the aspirations and values of the largest country on the planet, then I see very little to stop China and Russia coming together in mutual antagonism towards the West. That doesn't have to, of course, lead to war, not at all, but it does mean that we will be entering an unfortunate period in international affairs. Now, here's the second difference. In 1971-72, the world was split into two armed camps distinguished by ideological differences, communism and capitalism, to be very reductive. The world is now splitting along civilizational lines or cultural lines. China is, according to Martin Jakes in his book, When China Rules the World, a civilizational state. And Putin has been using the term civilizational state since the Valdai meeting in 2013. What is a civilizational state? Well, to begin with, it's a post-Westphalian state. It's not a nation state. It's bigger than a nation state. It's a nation state plus. It has its own value systems. It has its own beliefs. It has its own language. And that means it is not susceptible to American liberal internationalism or American liberal interventionism or democracy promotion. Or nation change, or nation change, or regime change. There used to be a mantra with the neoconservatives in Washington just after the fall of Baghdad. After Baghdad, Beijing. Let's go for the real regime change, the real historical event. Of course, this has always been still, I think, in the American imagination or the imagination of some. It is not in Donald Trump's imagination. It was in Hillary Clinton's imagination. But it is not in Donald Trump's. Narratives are very important for civilizational states. Historical events are important for civilizational states. Every civilizational state has its own historical myth. Every nation state has its own historical myth. The Frenchman Renan, back in 1882, called history the social capital on which the national idea is based. And if that has been true of the nation state, it's certainly true of the civilizational state, the social capital on which the nation state is based. What is the historical narrative for China? It's the two Anglo-Chinese wars of the 19th century, which are taught in patriotic history courses for some time. That's the national myth. Who cares about whether you know about the six dynasties or not? The important thing is to remember what happened in 1840 and what happened in 1860 when the, of course, famous Summer Palace was burned down in Peking. But there's a point to this story. And the point to the story is not that China was a victim in the 19th century. China has been a victim over and over again of nomadic conquests, two foreign dynasties. People don't even talk about Qing dynasty now. They talk about a Sino-Manchurian dynasty, some historians, because it wasn't, of course, a Chinese family that was ruling China at the time. But China has had the enormous success, which is why it's the oldest civilization on the planet and why it has survived, of being able to assimilate the people that have arrived uninvited and unannounced across the Great Wall, or even before the wall was built. There are 56 different ethnic groups in the People's Republic of China who genuinely believe they are Han Chinese. That's extraordinary. No civilization has ever managed to pull off that trick before. But the nomads who couldn't be assimilated came by sea in the 19th century, and they were not impressed by Chinese civilization. They were impressed by industrial civilization. They could not be assimilated. And that, of course, is the lesson that has been remembered. The West is the only enemy of China. Could be an enemy again, might be an enemy one day, is the threat. Not a Russian threat, not an Indian threat, a Western threat. So that's important. And the third point of a civilizational state is it has a core value system. In this case, it's Confucianism. Confucianism and communism are now tied at the hip. Xi Jinping pays an annual visit to Confucius's birthplace every year. The texts are now taught in Chinese schools, and they're now compulsory texts for young party members. And this, of course, despite the fact that at many different times in the past, the Chinese have made fun of Confucius and sided with the Taoists against his dogmatism. Indeed, for three centuries, between the first and fourth centuries of this era, the young rebelled against the collective social norms of Confucianism as unnatural. What I'm saying, of course, is there are many different cultural traditions in Chinese history by virtue of the fact that China has had a longer history than anyone else. Confucianism is merely one of them, but it has been picked by the party because of certain traditional conventions about hierarchy, obedience, respect for one's elders, etc. It's a very convenient core essence of what is now called the Chinese mind. The third and final difference is that when Nixon visited Mao Zedong, there was a value-based system determined by two countries, Russia and the United States. Now, we have a challenge to an American rules-based order from two countries, from China, from Russia, and from ISIS, which is not a country. One is bending the rules in the South China Seas, one is breaking the rules in the Crimea, and the third wants to throw away the rule book altogether. So we are beginning to see a debate about what the new international order will look like. And that debate will involve President Trump, the first American president, to be involved in that debate. What will it look like? Well, we don't know, because the Chinese leadership doesn't know. It's very coy about what it wants to achieve. And it has problems. And the problems were cited by a member of the Chinese Foreign Affairs Institute University a few weeks ago. China is not yet ready for a leadership role in the world for two reasons. It doesn't have enough interest in the fate of the outside world. That's a reality, he says. Chinese people are not kept awake at night by what's happening in Aleppo or in Africa or anywhere else. It's a reality. That will change with social and economic circumstances. And secondly, China has no idea of public goods to replace the two public goods the United States is still promoting and selling, democracy and human rights. The only other one would be environmental, perhaps. So China's now got to find something that can rival democracy and human rights. The Chinese message is harmony with difference, that different civilizations should live in harmony with each other. Different civilizations, different value systems must live in harmony with each other and respect each other enough to accept that they will be different. They're not going to converge and become the same. In other words, the Chinese are talking about an inter-civilizational dialogue, which is very different from the dialogue that was conducted by Mao Zedong and Richard Nixon, who both represented universalist value systems, claimed to represent universalist value systems. As far as we know, there are three ways in which I think things could go. The first is China claims to be a civilizational state that is not engaged in the kind of zero-sum maneuverings that they blame the Western powers for. For the West, there's always a number one. For the West, it's either the American century or the British century. For the West, there's always great power competition. There's always balance of power competition. There are always alliances. That's a Western game which the West has been playing in its part of the world for a long, long time. I like to say that my own country has invaded, occupied, or passed through uninvited all but 22 members of the United Nations. An unprecedented and unrivaled record, which I don't think will ever be exceeded by anyone else. China would argue that its historical record is very, very different. And sure, there's a tribute system, or what we call a Sinosphere, that was run for 700 years quite successfully. But they like to point out that the tribute system was about giving, not taking. The West exploited, took the slaves, took the gold, forced itself into foreign markets. Whenever you
enter the tribute system with China, the Chinese exchequer went into the red because the emperor had to give more. It was gift-based. The second point I would make is that China claims it has never had a civilizing mission. Korea is the only country to have introduced Confucianism in the 14th century. It did so voluntarily. The Chinese were not interested in whether it introduced Confucianism or not. It's never had colonies. As such, it's never had an empire. So in that sense, it says it's the only really true great power that actually has been a non-zero-sum great power in its relationships, and that this is completely foreign to Western history, and the West doesn't understand how this works. It's an interesting argument. And the third argument is that the new society China seems to be wanting to build doesn't really have much place for the new players in the Western camp. Doesn't have much place for NGOs, doesn't have much place for civil society movements, doesn't seem to have much place for INGOs. These have been, in a sense, considered to be a Western thing. So it's not quite sure at the moment what kind of society is being built. And here's what looks as though it's being built: two parallel world systems. An American-centered world system and a China-centered world system. And you can see this with the institutions that are now coming into place: the Ocean Infrastructure Investment Bank, the Belt Road, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the Chinese initiative, which is now doing extremely well, that Donald Trump has announced that he's not interested in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Two parallel worlds living side by side, rather uneasily, attracting different people, trying to bring them to one side. This looks to be the likely future in the short term. So to conclude, the world has changed. The election of Donald Trump is a reflection of that fact. There are three things about Donald Trump. First, he's quite at ease with a world in which the United States is no longer the superpower. He's not interested in the United States being a superpower. He's not interested in a unipolar world. He's not interested in liberal internationalism. He wants to do bargains with countries that are peer competitors of the United States. So that's good news for China. Second good news for China is he is also interested in the civilizational state. His whole argument is that Western civilization is being eroded from within by political correctness, by multiculturalism, by aggressive secularization. He calls it the new barbarity. This is Steve Bannon's coin, the new barbarity. The barbarians are not outside the gates, they're within the gates. And that's our mission, to deal with that and save Western civilization. Our mission is not to dream for China or the Russians. Let them get on with their own civilizational values. So that should be good news. And apparently, he is willing to give Russia what Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, calls an area of privileged civilizational interest in Ukraine and Belarus. Can you imagine Donald Trump perhaps giving China an area of civilizational privileged interest in the South China Seas? We don't know. Donald Trump, I think, could be seen as the Manchurian candidate. In every respect. Some of you probably don't know the film, The Manchurian Candidate. Now, here's the thing, and this is my last comment. Donald Trump's first 100 days in power will fall on the centenary of Woodrow Wilson's speech to Congress in which he took the United States into the First World War in 1917. So basically we've had a consistent American foreign policy with some ups and downs. There was never any isolationism in Asia. Don't talk to Asians about American isolationism in the 20s and 30s because it didn't exist. This is going to be the first president, perhaps, who's going to break with the Wilsonian tradition. This is going to be the first president who has no interest in what happens inside China, perhaps on tariffs for the American workforce. Yes. So this is a world in which the United States, for the first time, will no longer be dreaming for China, which is great news for the Communist Party in Beijing. but may not be such great news for the Chinese people. Well, perhaps it might. I don't know the answer to that question. But I think that this is a momentous historical moment, because the United States has given up dreaming for other people, is about to, because it needs to start dreaming for itself. And on that note, I will end.
Thank you very much, Christopher. I've got a lot of questions of my own, but I won't abuse my position of the chair just yet, maybe in a moment or two. So why don't we just throw the up to the audience. The gentleman over here, the gentleman over there. Take you first, please. Yeah. Try and make the question single warheads, i.e. one question, please, and not four in one. Please.
Thank you very much for both of your speeches. My question is, so recently, I just saw on the news there was a cybersecurity pact between China and Russia, which some people are saying is an extension of the Great Firewall. Do you think the internet is going to be a microcosm of sort of the power play which is going to be coming in the future, or do you think it's going to be a key playing field? Okay. So do you think...
Thanks. One on Russia, China, and cyber. Gentlemen here.
Without negating the importance of technological advances, I think the linguistic, amazing, semiotic point which you just raised, that in the character about America is the word beautiful. I mean, this is the most important information I have ever heard. And I would want to know, are there other characters in the Chinese language which indicate our absolute ignorance of the semiotic civilizatory aspect of simply the language, the recording matter which fixes meaning? Yeah, it is, I think, the most significant information I've heard for the last 10 years.
Well, I'm Christopher.
Thank you.
I'll take one more here. What's on semiotics and language and Chinese characters, about which I'm sure you know a great deal.
Of course.
And the lady there, please, yeah.
Thank you for excellent presentations. I just have one simple question. How many terms do you think that Donald Trump will run the presidency? One or two or less than one? Thank you.
The answer is three.
Yes, three.
Yes, the Constitution could be changed any time soon. Yeah? Who knows? Margaret, why don't you have a go at any of those questions, including Chinese characters? Get the microphone. So, can you hear okay at the back? Yeah, good. Yeah, Margaret, please.
It's a small room. Well, I mean, I think Chinese characters are very rich, like any language, and because it's an ideogrammatic language, what the characters are is very interesting. I mean, the alphabet doesn't have the same sort of meaning. And I don't speak or read Chinese, so I can't help you there, but I'm sure my neighbors do, so I'll ask them to say more about that. But I just wanted to say something about the internet, because it already is a battlefield, and we've gone very quickly from the internet as something that's completely open and free to something that is clearly being controlled increasingly by powerful interests or by governments. And there is a very interesting sort of move against that, to see the World Wide Web as something like a highway, which is a common good, and the internet is something that is built on it. But I think we all understand there needs to be more regulation. The Facebook is still denying that false stories on Facebook had anything to do with the American election. Still, Mark Zuckerberg is still not wanting to have any editorial function. But I think that will have to come, because it is something that is so enormously influential. We can't just say it happens. I think we're already seeing conflict on the internet and in cyber. Cybersecurity is one of the big worries for the military everywhere. It's one of the big battlefields. Predicting Donald Trump, I think, maybe the I Ching can do it. I can't. He's unpredictable. I mean, I don't think he knows what he wants. He's quite capable, I think, of getting bored We were talking on the elevator. He's not going to want to live in the White House. It's too small and too white. He's not enough gold. He said he's going to live in New York.
Yeah.
And just visit the White House every so often. But you know, I think being president actually can involve a bit of work. And I think he's not temperamentally suited to the sort of boring, hard slog of, you know, talking to his cabinet, reading the papers, trying to get up on things. I mean, he doesn't know much about a lot of the world. He doesn't really care. Other presidents might feel a bit embarrassed that they don't really know where certain countries are on the map. He won't worry. He'll know if he has a hotel there.
Or a golf course.
Or a golf course, right. Yeah.
Okay.
Read the annual accounts.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He's got business interests all over the world.
Well, Donald Trump, it's an excellent advertisement, really, for the Chinese Communist Party, because they've always suggested that the United States was an asymptomatic carrier of a deadly disease called democracy. But it's no longer asymptomatic. It has just succumbed to the disease. It's no longer a carrier. It's a victim. And Donald Trump is the evidence for this. You know, you have to remember that the criticism that is made of democracy in China is usually on meritocratic lines, that to aspire to be president of China, let alone a cabinet minister of China, you need to put in 20 or 30 years of hard grind and service. You need to be a provincial governor, a boss at the highest level, somebody who's actually had two or three different jobs in your life within the government service, not some kind of businessman who just breezes on to the scene 9 months before, who's been five different political parties in his lifetime. A bit like Bernie Sanders, who only became a Democrat on the day that he filed for the New Hampshire primary. Surprise, surprise. So, basically, this is very good for China. That if you want a kind of Confucian oligarchic meritocratic system, which is now being talked about as a possible democratic road for China to take, it's certainly not going to be the Western model. It's certainly not going to be the American model. Because look at the mess that the West is getting itself into, not just in the United States, but across Europe as well. Mm. So keep looking at that. There's supposed to be, by the way, three houses in the the ideal Chinese parliament: House of the People, House of the Earth, and House of the Heavens. And one of the leaders is supposed to be of the House of the... So the House of the People, or the House of the Earth, is meant to be a descendant of Confucius's. The only problem is there are 2 million people who claim to be descended from Confucius. 1.2 million were added last year when women were allowed onto the list. Mm. So it's going to be quite a struggle. Now, on the question of... it is a nice story, isn't it? But unfortunately, it's not the story I'm going to tell you, because there is a movement called cultural nativism in China, which is a fight back to reclaim language. The problem with the Chinese language is that it has changed to... It has been modernized, and it has been open to Western categories of thinking that are completely new. So, for example, in ancient Chinese, classical Chinese, one of the genesis was elegance and beauty. For example, the pine tree. You would define a pine tree as beautiful, thistles as ugly. Similarly, if you're looking at, for example, noble and ignoble animals, animals were defined as to whether they were noble or ignoble. The lion was noble, the fox was ignoble. Well, of course, that's all gone out with all these modern scientific classifications that go back to the 18th century, etc., etc. And there are many nationalists who are outraged by this. And they argue the Chinese language is unique to China, is part of the Chinese soul. The Japanese said the same thing in the 1930s, at the end of the 19th century, about their own language when they talked about the Japanese soul. And that the Chinese characters enter the bloodstream and the thoughts and the unconscious of the Chinese people. You asked me whether I spoke Chinese. I don't speak a word of Chinese, but that wouldn't help me, because if I were the most brilliant sinologist and the most brilliant linguist, I would not have been born Chinese. Therefore, I cannot understand China. This is really a serious challenge to the idea that ideas do travel, that translation does exist. The translation actually allows you to see your own ideas through other people's eyes, and sometimes to unlock possibilities that you haven't even seen in another language. But that no language is inaccessible to anyone else, and no culture is inaccessible to anyone else. And so, the Chinese government has not championed cultural nativism. but I'm afraid language has entered the political debate as one of the many features of the civilizational state. The language has been politicized now, and it is being politicized at the moment.
Margaret, can I ask you to come on to one of the themes that you developed, without developing really at the end of your excellent lecture, on where you think the relationship might go? You said that the British and the Americans came to a deal sometime in the late 1890s over the Venezuela crisis issue and a number of others, the beginning of the special relationship, if you like, which was consolidated in the 20th century around two wars and the Cold War, and other things as well, language, many other cultural issues as well. So that didn't lead to the clash of a rising and a declining power. But that meant that both Britain and America shared quite a lot in common, you know, in terms of their historical origins. You know, America was, after all, a byproduct of the British Empire, largely, not entirely. The language of the United States, it seems, is English. So many British emigrants went to the United States. Many of the laws were British, and the rule of law, and indeed you could even say the American War of Independence was a war made for British values, British constitutionalism, against what was now seen as the Crown, which was taking away English liberties or British liberties. So you could say, therefore, it wasn't just there was a rising power and a declining power called the British Empire on one side and the United States on the other. There was a very deep, profound sense of overlap between two countries, which was also consolidated around notions of white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism and empire. And I could therefore see why the British and the United States could make the deal, if you like. And it's not just about power. It would seem to me that if one's following that argument through, if you want to, and I'm sorry to go on for so long, and this is the question now, you don't have that same kind of overlap. I mean, that follows from Christopher's point about different civilizations. Do you think that's going to make a difference to the future of the relationship or not? Or do you think other things will outweigh those considerations?
I just think it's very hard to tell how it will play out, because Germany and Britain had a lot in common before the First World War. They were each other's greatest trading partners. They had all those family links from the royal family on down. Mm. I mean, the British royal family spoke German much more fluently than it spoke English until about 1914.
Mm. Still does.
Still does.
And they had German name, of course.
And you had a sense of Protestantism. Mm. You know, you had a sense of, you know, the Teutonic peoples, which might or might not include the English. Mm. China and Japan had a huge amount in common, you know, the culturally, you know, so I don't think that necessarily makes you more friendly. I take the civilizational point, but I'm worried about it because it seems to assume there is no possibility for different civilizations to talk to each other. And they always have. And it also assumes there is something called that civilization and this civilization, which are like little bits of agate which never meet. And, you know, you think of the way in which the Chinese like to tell themselves that they have this civilization which has lasted unchanging through the millennia. And, of course, it's changed. You know, Chinese civilization changed enormously in the Tang Dynasty, for example, when it was actually a particularly open dynasty and when the horse was introduced to China, when new ideas were introduced to China. You know, and Chinese ideas were introduced to other countries around China. Buddhism came from India and became part of Chinese culture. So the idea that civilizations never change or there's something essence. And I think the same thing is true of Western civilization. I mean, I think it is constantly changing. Mm. And constantly civilizations are affecting each other. So, I understand that different peoples have different ways of looking at the world, but I think sometimes you get political leaders using it for their own benefit. Yeah. You know, you do get talk among the Chinese leadership about how China is different. No one else can understand it. No one can understand the language. And I think, if I may just add one thing, I think they're making a big mistake in promoting Confucius, because Confucius is not just one message and has never been one message down through the centuries. You've had reinterpretations of Confucianism, and there is a side of Confucianism which is actually quite subversive of authority, which insists that you should make up your own minds, which insists that you should internalize moral values. You know, and you think of Mencius, the great disciple of Confucius, when someone said, should you rebel against a king? He said, if he behaves like a king. And if he doesn't behave like a king, he's no longer a ruler. He's no longer fit to rule. So I think, you know, I think the Chinese leadership may find they've opened a door that they wish they hadn't.
Yeah. Christopher, do you want to come in on that question? Or
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the neo-Confucianism, there is a liberal Confucianism, and there is an illiberal Confucianism. The party's going with the illiberal Confucianism at the moment. Yeah. There was a neo-Confucius movement in the 20s and 30s. There was another Confucius reform movement at the end of the 19th century. And these had all very different ideas. What is Confucianism? Yeah. It's very, very difficult to tie it down. It's whatever is really relevant for the present day and what is valuable for the present day, which is why it survives. It's constantly being reinterpreted and adapting to present circumstances. Yeah. So I don't, but I can see why the party finds Confucianism attractive at the most shallow level.
Yeah.
And as you say, it will overhear itself saying things and come to believe them. Yeah. That's the real problem.
Yeah. Okay, I got a lot of hands going up. Oh my gosh, quite frightening. I'll take three. One, two, and three. Cherry, then. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just shout, Cherry.
Right, okay.
Okay. You've got a strong voice.
Right, you can hear my voice. Vijay from LSE Ideas, a Runtown program here. My question is to both speakers. As Chairman Mao has really famously said in the 1970s, saying he'd like the right because the right gets things done, said by the left. Mm. And would you consider, by being a right person, that kind of right, political right person, like White House, somehow more likely to work together, work better with Xi Jinping, or Donald Trump is just Donald Trump himself, something completely different from any previous Republican president. So that's my
question. Okay, so America can work better with Republicans and the right than they can with liberals and Democrats. Yeah. Lady in blue, please. Thank you.
It was great lecture. Thank you. One question I have, it's about the economic war. Can this clash of titans mean that we're going to have economic war during the Trump presidency?
Okay. Will we have an economic war if he lasts one term? And then the lady behind, please. Yeah. And then that'll keep us going.
So, Mr. Choker, you said so China is not interested in outside world or taking leadership of the other of the whole world, but there's actually a booming, growing nationalism in China, and seems that the current government is actually encouraging this trend. And besides that, we see the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and seems like China is in some way wants to take leadership. And now we have the Brexit and the U.S. election, and there's a lot of discussion in China, and this is actually gave China more political space to play in the world. So what do you see this trend?
Okay, thanks. That's three good questions. Christopher, why don't you kick off?
Well, the old phrase, cometh the hour, cometh the man. So what you're suggesting is that there's going to be a leadership vacuum in the world. Unnecessary. It's been created by Brexit. It's been created by the travails of the European Union, particularly its external action policies, and also a United States, which is looking inwards with or without Donald Trump. If that is indeed the case, then yes, vacuums have to be filled, and China will probably try to fill the vacuum, but it will do so reluctantly. This was never supposed to happen so quickly. You know, those conferences that used to be organized in China back in 2006 before the financial crisis, how can we manage America's decline? How can we prolong the decline? How can we slow it down? Because we are not yet ready. Think what the party wants to achieve. It wants to still be there in 2049 for the centenary celebrations. It wants the average per capita income to be about, $25,000 or slightly more by 2049. It wants the Communist Party rule to be so embedded in China that the party is essentially safe and is considered legitimate. Now, these are not the ambitions of Vladimir Putin. When Vladimir Putin is describing the survival of his personal regime, he has to do foreign adventures because he can't deliver on any of these fronts. Mm. Therefore, he has to entertain the Russian people by occupying Crimea or by bombing Aleppo or by saying we're now the big superpower in the Middle East. We're the ones defending Judeo-Christian values against Islamic fundamentalism, which is the latest line coming out of the Russian foreign ministry. China doesn't have to do any of this. Plus the fact, I would actually say, China's internal problems are actually even greater than Russia's internal problems structurally. And you've got a lot of things. I mean, you've got the demographic crunch coming in 2019.
you'll be running out of labor after 2019. The population will start going down very dramatically. The aging of the population, you're going to be the oldest country in the Pacific Rim by 2050 in current projections. And you've almost got to negative fertility rate. So not reproducing. Now, of course, the Russians have all these things as well. But in Russia, the situation is always more containable because the Russian population seems to have an infinite capacity for suffering. And an infinite capacity for telling itself about the national mission, the messianic role, the Russian soul. Solzhenitsyn saying that there's never been a decent Western novel because Charles Dickens and Baudelaire and Balzac, they simply didn't know enough suffering. And I don't think this kind of narrative would go down terribly well in China. No. So basically you have to deliver and keep delivering. Service delivery is what the party knows it's all about. And they don't really want to get tied down in unnecessary foreign adventures and unnecessary confrontations with the United States, quite frankly, I think at the moment, as long as there are reasonable people in the United States who are also willing to react to opportunities that are coming along. Okay, so that's the rather long-winded answer to your question. You know very well from talking to me before that I know nothing about economics. So, sorry, I can't answer that question. Tariffs and things like that. I'm sure there are economists in the room. And what was the first question?
Mao.
That was about...
Oh, right.
China liking the right.
Yes. Well, somebody once said, and I forget who it was, that it must be very irritating for a Chinese leader during the biannual meetings with his opposite number in the United States to be seated with a person who's sitting there thinking, you have no right to be president of China because no one's democratically elected you. But Donald Trump has no interest in whether you've been democratically elected or not. He probably wasn't democratically elected. Who knows how many votes he actually managed to get, courtesy of Vladimir Putin or anybody else. The thing is, he doesn't care about these things. He's not in the business of democratic politics. He's a businessman who's in the business of doing deals with whoever he can do a deal. And that's going to be a fundamental difference. I know it's only a very slight little mood music, but I think the mood music might actually be more positive in the relationship between China and the United States. But of course, look, I'm trying desperately to put a positive spin on Donald Trump because I'm a contrarian and I like to annoy people. And most of you can't imagine anything good coming out of the Trump experience, and you're probably right.
Margaret.
Well, I guess one of the questions is how right-wing Donald Trump is. I mean, he's run on a populist platform. He's talked about the working classes. You know, I think what Mao meant, and I can understand it, was that you knew where you were with Republicans because they cared about power and they cared about trade, and they didn't care about things like human rights. And I think what the Chinese and other authoritarian leaders have always found difficult are American political leaders who talk about human rights, who talk about issues which don't seem to them to be dealing with international relations. And I think they've always found sort of democratic leaders to be deeply troubling because they seem insincere and contradictory. So I think any Republican who behaved like a capitalist should behave was something the Chinese understood, as the Russians did. Whether there'll be an economic war, I think Trump talks as if he's going to start one, but when it gets right down to it, world economies and world production are now so interlocked. So if he starts putting up tariff barriers against Chinese raw materials, not Chinese raw materials, Chinese parts, for example, that are needed in the cars that are being made in the United States, if he starts making consumer goods that are made in China and elsewhere in the world a lot more expensive, then that's going to hurt the American consumer. I mean, all Americans, or most Americans, are producers and consumers. And people are not going to want to pay a lot more for their televisions and for their shirts. I mean, Walmart is relies on cheap products from around the world. But the interlocking nature of production, I mean, very few things are produced in any one country. One part is produced here, it's shipped there, it's assembled there, it's produced, you know, then moved on to somewhere else. And so it may be that Donald Trump will find that reality makes it impossible, when he actually begins to look into it, to erect the sort of tariff walls that he's been talking about. The final question was China's nationalism. And I think, you know, I think the Chinese, if they, then they clearly do have aspirations to leadership, will probably, for the time being, want to do it in their own neighborhood. That's where their interests are, in the seas and lands around their neighborhood. They're talking of building the new sea routes and the new route through Central Asia. Will be a complicated one. And they're already beginning to run into some of the problems that expansive powers have run into in the past. They're getting local reaction. They're getting, in Africa, the Chinese have been investing heavily, and there's now a lot of pushback from people in Africa saying, but you're not giving us jobs. Mm. You know, you're bringing in your labor. The money is going back into China. How are we benefiting? I mean, this always happens. I mean, you know, external powers don't find always that they're very loved. What worries me about China's nationalism is the way in which it is used, I think, by the leadership of the Communist Party, because the Communist Party doesn't stand for communism anymore in China. It hasn't for a long time. I mean, there was that famous moment when someone said to a Chinese official about 20 years ago, you're allowing capitalists into the party and you're allowing free enterprise. How can you still call yourselves communists? And he said, if it works, we call it socialism, you know, which is a very clever way of dealing with it. But what does the party stand for? I mean, it is very successful at maintaining itself in power, but it doesn't stand for a very clearly defined political ideology. And I think what they've been using, and the temptation is to continue using, is Chinese nationalism, because it's a way of mobilizing people, it's a way of justifying the Communist Party leadership. But the danger with something like nationalism is once you begin to mobilize it, it can get out of control. And, you know, if you have generations who have been brought up on patriotic education, who have been told that the world has always treated China very badly, who have been told that China's always a peace-loving nation, but everyone else gets it wrong, then I think the government is going to find it's going to be pushed by its own people, possibly in directions it doesn't want to go. I mean, this happened during do you remember there was that row between China and Japan a few years ago?
2012.
Yeah, and the mobs began getting out of control. People began smashing Toyota showrooms in Chinese cities, and that wasn't what the government wanted, and they hastily clamped down. But they may find one day that they have created something which they are going to find difficult to clamp down on. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's fine. I'm going to take one final round of questions. There's a lot of hands. There's a lady at the front here, gentleman here, a lady there, and anybody else I'll pick up. If you can ask a question quickly, we'll try and take as many as possible. Okay.
Thanks very much. So many Chinese students go to university in the United States and in Europe, as we know from LSE 2. Coupled with the rise of research centers in China and their increasing sort of clout and the rejection of intellectual property rules by the Chinese, how will China's increase in competitiveness in research and development affect its relationship with the US and the world?
Right, that's not one for you then, Christopher, I think, given you know absolutely no economics at all.
Yeah.
R&D, yeah, go back, yeah, okay, yeah. Be quick, thanks. Yeah,
It's a very quick question. What do you see the future of Taiwan being now with Trump and sort of isolationism on the rise?
Taiwan and Trump, there you go. Who else is up here? Yeah, I'm going to just take anybody. Yes, I just grabbed the
question. I wanted to ask if it was intentional for not mentioning Taiwan in your introduction.
Was it intentional or just an accident of history? We don't know. Over here.
No, me.
Over here. Yeah.
Hello.
And, what about young generations? Because, for the time being, the current leaders never studied abroad or never lived abroad. But it will change at some point, even if, for the time being, the aim is the survival of the Communist Party. But is it possible in a few years' time?
300,000 Chinese students now studying in the United States, 30,000. Studying in the United Kingdom. 1,000 here, by the way. Over here? Yeah?
Sorry, I thought you told me to ask questions.
I'm going around to everybody.
Okay.
So
my question was, if, as has been suggested, Donald Trump has not really got the staying power and is going to get bored and not really kind of hold on to the reins of power very tightly. Surely this idea that potentially, you know, he's not bothered about the kind of maintenance of this unipolar hegemony that is the USA, and he just wants to do bargains, and he's also interested in the civilization state. Surely there's the risk that he may just defer to the grand old party and let them get on with it, and couldn't things just continue as they have been going previously?
Right. Okay. Anybody else? One last one to go. I think.
Very briefly, it's been my experience that Chinese people are have an appetite for democracy, but the kind of opinion is that whilst things are going well and they have economic growth, let's not change a model that's working. Do you think a decline in economic output could coincide with greater demands for democracy?
Right, okay, quite a lot there. Pick up what you want to pick up on, but leave R&D alone. Okay. Why don't you go first, Christopher?
Okay, just one thing. I'm aware of the time, with reference to the legitimization of the Communist Party, it's got itself in the paradoxical position of saying the following. It's because we're communists that you can trust us to regulate a market. Capitalist markets are unregulated to a certain extent. We regulate markets. And if you believe that, that's fine. But, of course, they haven't regulated the huge debt burden and the housing bust, which is going on at the moment. The other thing is, because we're atheists, religious freedom is absolutely guaranteed in China. We don't have any religious opinions. In fact, you're not allowed to have religious opinions if you want to be high up in the Communist Party. And therefore, as atheists, religion is safe in our hands. It's a fascinating communist argument. And the other, of course, is civilization. It's precisely because we're modernizers and we want to bring China into the 21st century that Confucianism is safe in our hands. This, in other words, this is a communist model that we haven't actually seen before, and I agree with you that they're not really communists, but they're fighting a bit of a backlash now from Maoists, from some new leftists and others, and they've got to be a little careful because there are people who believe in communism still, and they're fairly well placed. So I don't think we've heard the end of it. It's just a very paradoxical situation. Mm-hmm. Taiwan, never underestimate the importance of golf. All these Taiwanese generals play golf with PLA generals. They all have private email accounts like Hillary Clinton. Taiwan is owned entirely by the People's Republic of China now. Basically, Taiwan is an economic dependency of China, but there's a hell of a lot of Taiwanese investment in the People's Republic as well. In other words, the relationship is much closer than that between Hong Kong and China. There's no Taiwanese umbrella movement, and there's no real serious movement for independence. You hear it from time to time, and there are all these scares. I think that Taiwan is not a problem. I would think Hong Kong is more of a problem. I'm not quite sure the 50-year agreement is going to survive. I have no faith in the young generation, therefore I shall ignore this completely. Except to say, by the way, that Xi Jinping, who sent his daughter, I think, to Harvard, has said you should stop sending your children abroad because they bring back, they get toxified, they have to be detoxified, they bring back all these horrible Western ideas with them. And this is the civilizational state talking, really. West toxification was a term that the Russians invented at the end of the 18th century when they were arguing that young Russians shouldn't be sent to Western Europe for their education because they came back thoroughly infected. And by the way, the language of infection is the language that you hear, may remind you of the 1930s, infected with alien ideas. Not just bad ideas, but alien ideas. And lastly, Donald Trump. Well, look, there is one factor that I haven't mentioned. He is wants to expand the Navy to 350 ships. He wants to grow the Navy, as it's called. The Navy is absolutely 100% committed to dealing with China as the next potential big power on the block. And if you look at the language exchanged by Navy people, it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. And because that's where their bread and butter is. Mm. Remember Giuliani said, we've got 12 carriers?
Aircraft carriers.
China's only got one. That's very important for Giuliani if he becomes the Secretary of State, unless you've heard recently he's not. If you take General Mattis, who's likely to be the Defense Secretary, he's very tough on China. And the number one mission statement for the U.S. Navy going back to the founding years is freedom of navigation. That's what we're in the business of doing, or what Robert Gates, the former Defense Secretary, called the rules of the road. That was the number one position for the Royal Navy in the 19th century, maintaining open seas. If Trump is seen to negotiate this away because he says
South China Seas are yours, we're not concerned. And you have to look at the communications with the South China Seas, particularly internet communications. They're all there. It is the most heavily, most dense area of communications in the whole world. Then I think Trump's going to lose a lot of friends very quickly. I'm not saying he's in the pocket of the U.S. Navy, but insofar as he's privileging the U.S. Navy over the other services, also the U.S. Marine Corps, it has to be said, then I think you could have some possibility of confrontation in the next couple of years, an incident in the South China Seas. And Trump appears to constantly need to reassert his manhood whenever he possibly can.
Yes,
according to his former speechwriter, and that makes him a rather dangerous person.
You won't get bored then. Margaret.
I was just reflecting. We've talked far more about Donald Trump tonight than about Xi Jinping. It's very interesting, isn't it? I mean, we're sort of fascinated by him, partly, I think, because he is so incalculable. But, I mean, I think President Xi is also a very interesting person to look at, and his signals have been, I think, quite mixed. He has moved very quickly, to get rid of, I think, a lot of what he's been doing is purging the party of Maoists, actually. I think the whole Bo Xilai thing was a way of getting rid of people whose views were different from him. But he's also seems to me to have been accumulating more and more authority, which can be a dangerous thing, because if you accumulate a lot of authority, then you get blamed for more. But I think the relationship between these two individuals will be a very important part of the relationship between the two countries. Taiwan, I think, is fascinating. I mean, what they agreed in the famous Shanghai communique was to sort of let it ride, and they've been letting it ride ever since. The status of Taiwan is still unclear, but it seems to suit both sides, and it seems to suit the Taiwanese themselves, who managed to live on an island which the Chinese officially regard as being part of China, but don't do anything about. And this has now gone on since 1972, and people seem to be able to live with this rather interesting state of uncertainty. I mean, occasionally other countries say, can't we do what Taiwan does? Do we have to define ourselves as independent? I mean, the same thing has happened in other parts of the world. I think the issue of the younger generation is very important. And, of course, always when you talk about a country, you say China wants this, China wants that. But, of course, what you're doing is looking at lots of different people with lots of different ideas. Different generations, different social and economic interests. And I think what is so interesting about China is it is a country which has gone through a lot, is continuing to go through a lot of changes, and there are many different views within China about what this means. But one of the important factors, I think, is going to be the younger generation, who are more aware, even if they don't see China, of the outside world, simply thanks to communications, but more and more young Chinese traveling abroad. And they will come back, and they will have ideas. And I wouldn't call them Western ideas. They might have different ideas. But they will have, and if they don't leave China, they will have the same sorts of thoughts about how might China be a better society, how might we improve it. I mean, that's what you want young people to do. And I think there will continue to be a lot of discussion, both outside China and inside, about what path is China going down? Is it the right path? And there's a lot of discussion I find quite striking about the spiritual vacuum that people feel. You do get reports of younger generation saying, my life doesn't seem to have much meaning. It's all about consumerism. We've been told that to get rich is glorious. And maybe there are other things in life, which again is worrying for the party leadership, because if they're not filling that, there are other possibilities. I think that's one of the reasons why they reacted with such apprehension to Falun Gong. Because it was something that was positing a different way of looking at the world from the party, and that I think was seen by the party as a threat. But it's I mean, we have said the same sort of questions about Japan. I mean, Japan used to be, I think, the Japanese used to not to travel abroad as much, used not to study abroad as much. Foreigners didn't settle in Japan as much, and that has changed. And how that is going to change the outlook and fabric of Japanese society is absolutely fascinating. But again, I'd like to go back to my other point: civilizations and societies are always changing. I mean, the idea that possibly in the old days when you had very, very firmly rooted rural societies and people didn't move around very much, but societies today are changing constantly, and there are many different ideas. And I think what will be interesting is to see how these ideas work out in China about what Chinese society should look like.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark, and also thank you very much, Christopher. As you know, one of the purposes of ideas is to generate public debate and engagement on serious contemporary and historical
historical issues. We don't necessarily see a difference between history, the past and the present. And I hope that you found this particular discussion here this evening in the LSE and in the LSE ideas tradition, which we shall continue into the new year. I'd like firstly to thank you for all your very good questions. I think we nearly had 18. That's nearly a world record in half an hour. I'd also like to thank the team from Ideas who have done all the organisation for this tonight. I see them back, but thank you, Adriana, Joseph, and anybody else who's sitting there. But particularly, I'd also like to finally thank our two speakers this evening for presenting great talks and generating a great debate. Thank you very much indeed, everybody.